Some of America's bravest warriors are returning home wounded. Here's one of them.
My name is Norberto Lara. While I was on a combat patrol, a rocket propelled grenade took my arm off at the shoulder. I was discharged from the Army, and I've been working with the Wounded Warrior Project since 2007. You don't have to be severely wounded. A lot of guys have post-traumatic stress disorder. Being able to share your story kind of helps you wrap your mind around what did happen over there. My name is Norby, and yes, I do suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, but I'm okay.
Don't suffer in silence. Contact WoundedWarriorProject.org.
The Trade and Apprentice Education Division of the Henry Ford Community College is excited to present a new 10-credit hour renewable energy certificate program. The content of the courses will be structured to inform the students of both present and future renewable energy concepts. This certificate program should interest students who are looking for an alternative to our current reliance on fossil fuels. To learn more about this program, please contact the Trade and Apprentice Education Division at 313-845-9609 or on the internet at www.hfcc.edu.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
I'm Andy Parks, the host of Strictly Gospel, airing every Sunday afternoon from 3 p.m. until 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time here on WHFR, where we feature the very best in gospel music, gospel jazz, gospel hip-hop, urban contemporary, as well as traditional gospel music. Keeping it moving and grooving on the only station making waves, WHFR.FM.
The WHFR Monday Forum, an hour of a wide variety of one or more talk show programs from 6 to 7 p.m., some of which are locally produced.
Today turns into yesterday, leaving only words we say for this time.
New ideas and information, different each week, not available on other Detroit stations. That's why we're the station making waves, WHFR.FM. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to WHFR at hfcc.edu.
The good times, the hard times, this time is our time.
The WHFR Monday Forum, 6 to 7 p.m. And also listen to all locally produced talk shows on WHFR Tuesday Forum from 1 to 2 p.m. Disclaimer, this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our Board of Trustees, or students.
Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for downloading this episode of Philosophy Talk. Your support helps keep our program on the air and online.
Visit our website, philosophytalk.org, to keep up with the latest downloads and upcoming features.
And as always, thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We're continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken and I both teach philosophy. And
today we're talking about the right to privacy.
This is one of those times, Ken, when we probably ought to start by disentangling different uses or senses of the concept. We use private and privacy in different ways. Both words derive from privis, that's the Latin word, and it means single or individual. being private is usually opposed to being public, having to do with ownership or who can attend. Privacy, though, means something a little different. It means kind of being withdrawn in one way or another from the public or protected from it.
You know, there's another use that we have in philosophy. We apply the term private to our mental life. That has to do with the fact that only I know directly, anyway, what I'm thinking and feeling. Other people may know what I'm thinking and feeling by being told it or observing me and guessing, but I know it directly. I have these private mental states that only I'm aware of.
And a great thing about your thoughts is you don't have to do anything special to keep your thoughts private. Just keep your mouth shut and they'll be quite private. That's not the case with other things. I have to put curtains in my bedroom if I want to keep what goes on there private. If my neighbors are nosy, I might have to build a fence to keep them out.
Yeah, that's because it has to do with the fact that you consider your home your private sphere, a space where you can do what you want without anybody watching or interfering, without the fear of being molested by others, as John Stuart Mill put it. That's a kind of privacy that we care a lot about. You can even ask whether we have a right to privacy in that sense.
There's another aspect to this, or extension of it. We want to just not just protection from peering eyes looking at our naked bodies or what we're doing, but we want to be able to control and limit the access people have to all kinds of information about us that we think of as personal. If I keep a diary, I lock it. I password protect my financial files.
Not only do we want to keep that information private, if we do grant people access to that, we want some kind of control over what they do with it, over how it's used.
So we want privacy both in the sense of having some control about what others know about us, and also in the sense of being left alone to make our own decisions. Now, I'm kind of wondering, what do these different senses of privacy have in common? Do they have a root source?
I think maybe they do, John. I think they have their source in what it is like to be a human being. Look, human beings come with different properties that make them different from one another. We each have our own beliefs, desires, and values. And we come with the power to decide on the basis of these what to do with our lives. We want to control our bodies on the basis of our own decisions. I think both concepts kind of recognize this basic aspect of what it is to be a human being.
So do you think that simply by being human we have a right to privacy? What would the source of that right be? One might think it would be derived from something more fundamental, like the right of self-protection, the right to protect ourselves from harm. But do you think it's just simply based on human individuality and autonomy?
I don't know, John. Those are good questions, and they raise other important questions as well. For example, if I do have a right to privacy, does that mean that others have a corresponding duty not to spy on me, not to nose about in my personal affairs?
Well, I think that's going to depend on your personal affairs, Ken. If you're building a bomb in your garage and thus you present a risk of harm to other people, then the government has a right to come into your garage and find out what you're doing and stop it.
Well, so you're saying that if there is a right to privacy, it's certainly not an absolute right, because there are conditions under which it seems perfectly all right to violate someone's so-called privacy.
Yeah, although we have to be kind of careful here, especially in this day and age, because it's pretty easy to violate someone's right to privacy in a world with phone taps, GPS tracking, cameras everywhere. Your privacy is very invadable these days.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And our expectations of privacy are also, I think, diminishing because of all those things you talk about, which also leads to the erosion of any claimed right to privacy.
Yeah, and I don't want to sound grumpy, but you and all the younger generations are really screwing things up by your exhibitionism. Look at how you guys use the social media to tell us what you had for lunch. You tweet about where you're going and everything you do. And some people, I don't think you, post pictures of themselves after a night of debauchery. Our claims to privacy are pretty hard in a world where nobody cares about it anymore.
Well, John, I hate to say you do sound grumpy, but you know what? There's a lot to untangle here. And to help us get started, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, to find someone who cared so much about her privacy, she tried to become anonymous. Caitlin files this report.
Do you ever wonder what kind of information is out there about you on the internet?
I'm somewhat concerned, but not all that concerned. When you're talking about, vendors, I actively give information sometimes about myself just to make my own ad experience better.
I'm a little concerned about all the information that I've given to Facebook and whether they own it or what they can do with it.
I do worry about privacy when it comes to a discrimination, for instance. Like, will a life insurance company or a health insurance company find out information about me online and, like, change my rates based on that?
If you're not curious about the information that's out there about you, maybe you should be.
So I found this, like, crazy list where you could get the addresses and names of, it was 11,418 people, mostly men over age 55, who bought a particular herbal sexual potency product in September or October of that particular year.
Catherine Price is a writer in Philadelphia. A few years ago, she tried to disappear for a week to report a story called The Anonymity Experiment for the magazine Popular Science. It wasn't easy, and it led to some pretty interesting discoveries.
You can actually do a search online and find out what type of information is possible to buy. Like, if you were a marketer for a product and you wanted to be very targeted in who you're selling to.
So how do you become anonymous? Step one, get rid of your cell phone. Replace it with a prepaid disposable one.
Kind of like a burner in The Wire, if you've ever seen that show, that the drug dealers use. That was what I was supposed to be using. And then using a calling card on top of that so that if anyone were to steal my prepaid cell phone, they wouldn't have any access to outgoing numbers other than the calling card number.
Step two, mask your internet presence. Sign up for a service that blocks your internet provider from accessing information about your online activity. Then there's the issue of your email account.
It's like I was receiving email in one account, and then I was sending email from a different encrypted account so that it would be difficult to kind of link those two accounts together or tell what I was writing.
And then there are surveillance cameras. Avoid airports, government buildings, and public transportation. Be careful when driving. Do not cross toll booths. Services like Fast Track or Easy Pass keep a record of everywhere you've been.
That actually is how they do those estimated times between places. You know, when it's like 15 minutes to Berkeley, they do that by picking up a signal from your toll paying thing.
And of course, don't use credit or debit cards. Cash only. The most difficult day of Price's experiment in becoming anonymous came when she was attending, no joke, a privacy conference. She had to figure out how to get from Oakland to San Francisco without driving.
So I ended up using casual carpool, but I also decided that since there were so many cameras like en route to San Francisco that I probably should be really extreme and not just wear my hat and my sunglasses as I've been doing before, but to wear this face visor. But it makes you look either like a welder or a beekeeper, and it's not like really the kind of outfit that would invite you into people's cars.
Then there was the matter of renting a room. The first hotel Price went to wouldn't rent without ID.
It was just like a mess, and I ended up having to go across the street and stay at this hotel where they let me just flash my passport at them without taking it from me, and then I misspelled my name deliberately. So that was the best I could do, but that was definitely the most challenging day of the experiment.
Before writing the story, Price said she never felt like she had anything to hide, so she didn't think twice about the information that was being collected about her. Price assumed that her internet and bank activities were being recorded, but who would be interested in that?
You know, every time you use a supermarket loyalty card, it's keeping a record of all of your purchases. Or, for example, if you move, the moving company will sell your new address information. If you ever wonder why you start getting junk mail so quickly and how they possibly find you, it's because your information is sold. Pizza delivery places sell information. Stuff like that that really I just never would have even considered. And once I started thinking about that, I realized that I actually do care more about privacy than I thought I did before I started researching the article.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks for that report, Caitlin. I definitely learned something. I've never had a thought about controlling my ad experience before now. I'm John Perry. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ken Taylor.
And today we're asking about the right to privacy. We're joined now by Jeffrey Rosen. He's a professor of law at George Washington University. He's legal affairs editor at the New Republic, and he's co-editor of Constitution 3.0, Freedom and Technological Change. Jeff, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks very much.
Jeff, tell us, there's so many different fascinating things a lawyer can do, tax law, real estate law. How did you get interested in something interesting like privacy?
I was writing a series of articles during the Clinton impeachment about different aspects of privacy. I wondered, how is it possible that Ken Starr was able to subpoena Monica Lewinsky's computer and get her undeleted emails and the love letters that she'd never sent to Clinton? And after I'd written a couple of these pieces, a book editor that I'd been working with said, why don't you write a book about privacy? I did. I just found it was such a fascinating subject, and that was back in 2000 the book was published. Since then, the debate has been transformed by the explosion of the internet, by 9/11, and most recently by Facebook and social networking technologies. So it's the gift that keeps on giving. It's just a great topic.
It is a great topic. But now, if we read the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, the word privacy, I don't know if it appears, but it's not a big topic. When did it become, and how did it become a legal concept that attracts a lot of attention?
The most famous article on the rights of privacy was written in 1890 by Louis Brandeis, the future Supreme Court justice, and his colleague Charles Warren. And they wondered about a new technology, namely the instant press and the tabloid cameras that were proliferating everywhere, that was invading the social privacy of aristocrats like them. And they were so upset by this that they proposed a whole new series of torts, which sound like a delicious dessert, but are actually a kind of complicated and not entirely satisfying efforts to control invasions of privacy by fellow citizens against each other. But you ask, when did it really take off? I think people have always been interested in it, but ever since the explosion of the internet and of Facebook in particular, now all citizens are experiencing the invasions that used to be limited to aristocrats like Brandeis. And with 500 million Facebook users and billions of pieces of content being shared every month, the amount of gossip that used to be spoken in Brandeis's day that's now written down is leading people to lose jobs when they post embarrassing pictures about themselves, to take umbrage when people say embarrassing things. So I think the topic is just hitting home in the most personal way in recent years.
Jeff, you use the word invasion of privacy, and lots of people use that word, invasion of privacy. Of course, Facebook isn't an invasion of privacy. It's a giving away of privacy. But I want to ask you the question, why fundamentally should we care about privacy? That may be an obvious question, but let's just have a benchmark. Why should we care about privacy at all?
It's not an obvious question, and there are lots of answers. You talked in your introduction about human individuality, and I think that that's crucial when everything is exposed and we have no ability to control the amount of information that's shared with others. We're likely to be less individualistic, more homogeneous, less eccentric, less creative. Citizens in the Soviet Union were always looking over their shoulders or going into fields to have private conversations. They were more inhibited and it wasn't conducive with the freedom that's necessary for a liberal society.
So it sounds like you think that privacy is something about freedom to be the self I choose to be. Freedom of self-formation and self-government is essentially tied up with privacy. Is that a fair summary?
That would be one of several definitions of it. That might be associated with autonomy, the idea that we have some area of seclusion from government surveillance. On the other hand, another value that privacy protects is dignity. Unless I'm sure that my fellow citizens are not gazing into my window or not insulting me online or treating me with the respect that we all owe each other as fellow human beings, I'm likely to feel that my dignity is invaded. And in that sense, that's an area of law, not so much avoiding surveillance from the government, but avoiding indignities that fellow citizens visit on each other.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about the right to privacy with Jeff Rosen from George Washington University.
Is privacy a fundamental right, or does it depend on more basic rights? What do we do when our desire for privacy conflicts with other people's needs and desires?
Privacy, autonomy, and human dignity. When Philosophy Talk continues.
Every step you take, every breath you take, the police will be watching you. Well, actually, they won't, because like most rock groups, they broke up after a while. But at any rate, I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and we're talking about the right to privacy.
Our guest today is Jeff Rosen from George Washington University. He's co-editor of Constitution 3.0, Freedom and Technological Change.
So, Jeff, when we talk about the right to privacy, John and I were saying in the opening, it seems that there are lots of different things that we might be talking about. What's the basic sense of privacy that you have in mind, and why do we have a right to that?
Well, I think it's impossible to reduce to a single definition. We've talked about autonomy. We've talked about dignity. I think there's also a great interest in not being judged out of context. If all you know about me is the books I read or the music I listen to, you might think I'm one kind of person, but I assure you I'm much more interesting. I have many layers, and I'm not going to reveal them on first meeting. But is there a right to privacy? It's a hard question. It's not clear that there is a fundamental right that can't be balanced against other rights. The U.S. Constitution, as you mentioned, doesn't contain the word privacy. It does, as the introduction suggested, protect different aspects of privacy, the right to be secure in our persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures, protects the privacy of our homes from government surveillance. And actually, just recently, the Supreme Court extended that right and said that we also have a right not to be surveilled by global positioning system devices that are placed on the bottom of a car and used to track us for a month.
Jeff, let me stop you for a second. I want to take this to a more theoretical plane just for a little bit, right? Suppose
sure.
We were founding a society. You know, we were the original, we were in the, what Rawls calls the original position, and we were trying to decide how we're going to govern our lives together. Why would we want a society? I mean, our Constitution doesn't mention privacy, but we're wondering, would we have a Constitution starting from scratch that said, okay, citizens have a right to privacy and they have it for this reason? I want to know an answer to that question. How would it figure in our fundamental thinking about how to live a life together in a political state?
If we were creating a society based on the idea of limited government, we'd need a right to privacy to prevent the government from becoming a totalizing influence in our lives, from literally occupying not only our homes, but forcing us to redirect the course of our careers, seizing our bodies. We'd need to create a sphere of immunity in order to protect autonomy, which is a crucial part of liberty.
So I don't have a very deep understanding of recent developments, but I know that in Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court said there was a right to privacy, and then Bork, who was a candidate for the Supreme Court that didn't quite make it, but a very influential federal judge, I guess, says there isn't a right to privacy in the Constitution. It seems to me, that in the Bill of Rights, it's all about privacy. It's like they don't have to mention it because it's so clearly all about it. But is that naive? I mean, does Bork have a point? What's the crucial issue that, after these years of debate, has fallen out of this as important?
It is striking that the right to sexual autonomy, which is the right that Bork was questioning, remains controversial not only among conservatives, but even some liberal constitutional scholars who are personally pro-choice but think that the Supreme Court was just a bit too abstract when it derived a free-floating right of autonomy, not in any particular constitutional provision, but from a whole bunch of them. It was a case that protected the right to use contraceptives, the Griswold case, where Justice Douglas said there are many protections for privacy in the Constitution, the First Amendment protection for freedom of association, the Third Amendment prohibition on quartering soldiers in the home, the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. And from these different amendments, said Douglas, they create penumbras formed by emanations that create a broader and more. Yes, you giggle as the law clerks did when they read that phrase too. And I think people laugh at it because it's so grandiose and untethered to the constitutional text.
Wait a minute! I don't laugh. I actually think that sounds like a profound bit of deductive reasoning, because you put all these things together. Maybe the right of privacy isn't articulated as a separate and distinct thing. But the reasoning that you just led us through seems to me quite compelling. You said it in passing that the Constitution obviously protects, I didn't say obviously, protects various aspects of privacy. Well, this right against self-incrimination, the right to be secure in your possessions and all that stuff against unreasonable search and seizure, all that. It seems right to say that those are aspects of privacy, and you can add them all up into an overarching right to self-governance, autonomy, all that stuff. I don't think that. Why is that laughable reasoning? It seems to me profound and correct reasoning.
You were chuckling with pleasure, not with...
Well, John was chuckling.
It's a little free-floating for my taste, and I like my privacy as well as the next one, as Justice Black said in the Griswold case. But it seems that we're talking about different aspects of privacy here, the spatial privacy in the home, the freedom of bodily integrity that might be protected by the Third Amendment. And to conflate them and sort of mush them all together doesn't do justice to the very different interests they protect. That's why I do have some sympathy with the textualists, both liberal and conservative, who think that it would have been better to locate a right to privacy in Roe versus Wade, perhaps in interests against being in gender discrimination, for example, rather than a free-floating right of sexual autonomy.
Well, I love Justice Douglas, or I did love him when he was there to be loved, and I just chuckled because emanations from penumbras sounded like he'd been reading Plotinus. I tend to agree with you. Maybe a little airy-fairy. But now this new thing about the GPS, that sounds very concrete and practical. They can't do what I see them do on TV shows all the time, just put a little GPS device on my bumper. I feel a lot more private now that they've decided that. What was the reasoning of the Supreme Court there?
This was a really exciting case. I think it's the most important privacy case of the decade. And the various camps of justices had two different sets of reasoning. The conservative majority, led by Justice Scalia, basically focused on private property interests. They said that when the cops attached the GPS device on the bottom of a car without a warrant, they both seized it and invaded with the possessory interests of the owner. The concurring justices, led by Justice Alito, who no one expected to be such a tribune of privacy but just wrote a brilliant opinion, said it doesn't make sense to just focus on private property because the cops could have gotten the same information by subpoenaing a cell phone company or by accessing the LoJack GPS device that's already installed in the car. In other words, they wouldn't need physically to invade it. Alito said he wanted to draw a distinction between short-term and long-term surveillance. And he said when the police are following your movements 24/7 for a month, that does reveal so much more information about us than a short-term search that it should require a warrant, even if it doesn't invade the privacy of the home. This was the crucial leap that Alito took because until this case, the court had protected privacy in the home, but it's the Obama administration had said, we have no expectation of privacy in public places, and it was just so great to see the court reject that unnecessary and extreme claim.
So that, I take your point, and this is really cool stuff, but let's just slow down a little bit because there's a lot flying by me here, and I need to get my brain around two different things here. But protection against in your person and effect and all that from unreasonable search and seizure, right, in my home. Nobody can come into my home. But you said, I got this cell phone, right? I've got this cell phone. It's got a GPS device. I turn on my location. I turn on my enable location function often when I have my cell phone on me, right? And do I have an expectation that nobody can use that information? I let it be known to somebody, to Apple, to somebody, where I am all the time. Why can't the police just say to Apple, hey, we want to know where Ken was?
That's just what the Obama administration argued. That's what two lower federal courts held. But Justice Alito rejected that. He said, sure, in theory, the police could hire 1,000 officers to track me 24/7 for a month. But in practice, no one actually expects that to happen because it doesn't happen. There are limited resources. Now, the fact that you can use this cheap, tiny device to achieve the same surveillance that used to require an army of spies means that people empirically have an expectation of that sort of surveillance. And I think he was also suggesting that even if the technology became ubiquitous and people did expect they were being tracked by that way, there should be a normative ban on that degree of surveillance because it's not consistent with the freedom that we all need in a liberal society. So Justice Sonia Sotomayor really clinched this point in a concurrence where she said we should reexamine the doctrine that merely because I share my information with Apple, Apple gets to share it with the government. That's called the third-party doctrine, and the idea is that if I share information for one purpose, I have no expectation that it won't be shared broadly for other purposes. The Europeans have rejected that idea. Their data privacy law says that data shared for one purpose may not be disclosed for another without individual consent, and Sotomayor said the U.S. Supreme Court has to reexamine this blinkered and illiberal notion.
We've got a question from Greg Slater, one of our listeners by email. Actually, he sent us a ton of stuff. He's obviously passionately interested in this. But what I'm going to pick out is this. He says, the most toxic aspect of privacy invasion is the asymmetry access to private information between the powerful and the powerless. The powerful, those who wield power, the president, big money, have total access to information about us, while they themselves have total secrecy about their own actions. I'm not so sure about the latter part, but is this another case where we're just unprotected from the rich, no matter what we do, but they can be protected from us?
There is a tremendous asymmetry in information, as he suggests, and Justice Brandeis, my hero and the great hero of privacy, recognized that sunlight is the best disinfectant, transparency is crucial to a functioning democracy, and it's a way of evening the score. There's a series of fascinating cases now involving citizens who are trying to film their encounters with the police on the street with their cell phones. And some police departments have sued and said this violates wiretapping laws, but a bunch of courts have ruled against the police and said that absolutely, in order to ensure a symmetrical amount of power, citizens have to have the same ability to video the police as the police have to video citizens.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the right to privacy with Jeffrey Rosen from George Washington University and David in Mill Valley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, David.
Thanks very much. I'm very concerned about PG&E's rollout of smart meters, and would that not placing that device on the side of people's home affect a similar issue as putting a GPS device would on the bottom of a car? In other words, PG&E would be able to tell where what you are doing in your house at a given time. They'd be able to tell all kinds of things about that household, including and not limited to whether you're home or not. And I'll take my answer off the air, I suppose.
Thanks for the question, David. That's a interesting question, Jeff, and it's tied to lots of other things. What's your thought about that?
It's a very interesting question, and I have the same concern. Our local Pepco power company in Washington just put smart meters on our houses, and I tried to resist it, but it turns out you can't. So, of course, PG&E and Pepco are private companies, and they're not formally bound by the Constitution. But if the government wanted to go to PG&E to subpoena data about how much electricity I was using, then that might be a Fourth Amendment issue. There was a very interesting case involving thermal imaging technology in 2003, and there the Supreme Court, Justice Scalia, said before this thermal imaging information can be used, a warrant is necessary because it might, although it measures the heat on the outside of the walls, reveal intimate information about the inside of the house. And this was his example, such as the hour of the day when the lady of the house took her daily sauna or bath.
Right.
It was
right
out of classical literature, as you can imagine.
Jeff. Okay, it's one thing to want protection against the government, right? The all-seeing eye of the government. But I also want protection, privacy protection against the all-seeing eye of PGE. I know the Constitution doesn't really guarantee me that, but that's just as bad. There wasn't, in the early days, there was not a time, in the early days of our republic, that a commercial provider of some service did not have the power to peer into the microstructure of your movements. But now they do. I mean, you sit at your computer, you turn on your television. That's frightening.
You know, PG&E might be well advised to pay attention to their own gas mains and leave me in my house alone, but that's just...
So is there nothing we can do about the all-seeing eye of the capitalist commercial interest?
It's a fascinating challenge. This is an age, as you suggest, when PG&E, Google, and Facebook have more power over privacy and free speech than the government does, or even than any Supreme Court justice. And yet the Constitution doesn't regulate these private parties. What to do? Well, one option is to pass data privacy laws, as Europe has. Just last week, Viviane Reding, the European Data Commissioner, proposed a fascinating new right. She called it the right to be forgotten. It was originally proposed by the French, and it's right out of Sartre, of course. It's very existential. But the idea is, the contours are a little bit vague, but the idea is I should have the right to force a third party to delete data held about me in their databases. That's the least controversial part. But she goes on to say that even if that data is shared by others, in other words, I post something on Facebook and then others put it on their Facebook accounts, I should also have the right to take that down unless it's necessary to keep up in the public interest or there's some journalistic reason for keeping it up. That creates a huge amount of power in the Data Privacy Commission that's adjudicating these claims. Some have called for a new international commission of forgetfulness that would make these decisions on a case-by-case basis about what stays up and what comes down.
So we might say that, Facebook lies coiled in the heart of privacy like a worm. But if you could design a constitutional amendment to kind of cover all the things that have come up about privacy that don't seem covered by our creaky old Constitution and Bill of Rights, I mean, would that be a good idea? And what would it cover? We might not have time for all this before the break.
Well, actually, why don't you hold that thought until after the break, and then we'll start there. How about that?
Sounds good.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're questioning the right to privacy with Jeff Rosen, author of Constitution 3.0, Freedom and Technological Change.
Do you think privacy is undermined by technology? If so, whose fault is that?
Technology and the erosion of privacy, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Man, I don't care what in the world that you do, as long as you do what you say you're going to. Ain't nobody's business but your own.
Well, it's my business to tell you that I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Jeff Rosen from George Washington University.
So, Jeff, I was asking you as we went to break, about a constitutional amendment. Well, of course, there's the question whether a constitutional amendment would be a good idea. There's the question about whether you could ever get it passed. But maybe most interesting is, if you had the power to just hit a button and have one, what would it say about privacy?
You know, I would be reluctant to propose a all-purpose amendment that would cover all of the situations we're talking about. As I said, I'm suspicious of being too abstract when it comes to privacy and would rather specify different aspects of it. I also think there are strong free speech interests that might be threatened by something like a constitutional right to be forgotten, and would be uncomfortable for that reason. But if I have the power to magically propose a single privacy amendment, I think it would focus on data privacy. It would regulate the corporate sector rather than the government. And it would be something like this European notion that data shared for one purpose may not be disclosed for another without the consent of the individual. I think that would really empower people against Google and Facebook.
I think that's a really good amendment, and I think that goes back to Greg Slater's question. Our Constitution recognizes the power of the government, right? But it treats citizens as if they're all on an equal par, and then when you have corporations being persons, it treats the citizen and the corporation as if they're on equal par without recognizing that the corporation has a power that can be abused. And that I think that would be an important amendment. But let's let some callers in here. William in Albany's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, William.
Hi, thank you. I'd like some comment on the following. It seems to me that this involves very centrally the notion of choice. That the difference between a violation of privacy and not a violation involves choice. And so you invoke your privacy when you say, I have the choice to refuse to allow you to give away my information. And so the defining privacy can define also the limits of choice. I'd like you to comment on that.
Thanks for the call, William. I'm not quite sure I fully understand the question. Jeff, do you get the question?
I think so. I think what William is getting at is the notion, maybe another way of saying choice would be control. And it's certainly true that one of the core definitions of privacy is the ability to control how much information about myself is disclosed to others. If that's a helpful rephrasing, then I'd agree that control is central to many definitions of privacy.
So let me ask you another question about given the world we live in. Look, if I were in the 17th century, I would not have the expectation that if I went out in the public, people could be following my every move. If I moved about my house, the firewood company or the coal company or whatever could follow, But now, there are certain expectations that I can no longer have about what people have access to. Does that change an expectation? Well, how does that change an expectation? What we construe as the privacy rights.
Yes, it's such a fascinating question, and this is the one the court struggled with in the GPS case. They basically said, how can we ensure the same amount of privacy in the 21st century as citizens took for granted in the 18th? And how has technology changed those expectations? So in the 18th century, the 17th century, not only do I use firewood from the Royal Firewood Company rather than PG&E, but I store my private diary in a locked desk drawer in my home. And in that sort of world, protecting the private property rights of the home against trespass will protect my diary. Nowadays, I store my diary not in the home, but in the digital cloud, on third-party servers owned by Google and Yahoo. And in this sort of world, if we accept this odd notion that if I turn over information to Google for one purpose, I abandon all expectation of privacy for it for all purposes, then I have much less privacy in the 21st century than the 18th century framers. That's why you might have to change the focus on private property and focus now more on the normative question of where can I have a place for my private papers to be secure regardless of where they're physically stored.
Jeff, when I watch TV, it's almost always British mysteries. And you look back at Sherlock Holmes or even Poirot, they really didn't have the ability that the modern detectives like Luther have. Apparently in England, because I'm sure these TV shows are completely accurate, every step that anybody takes in any big city is video cammed or videotaped or something, and the police just go and they say, ah, yes, there's a man coming out of the murder site at 1103 and so forth and so on. Now, is that kind of thing... that's different than the internet, but in a way it's just the idea that there's this kind of huge, eventually there'll be this huge videotape, international videotape that's shared by all the police agencies. That's just a videotape of everything that's happening in the world at every second. How can you have any privacy in a world like that? And is that going to happen in America?
You're absolutely right, and it's not science fiction. I was at a conference at Google just a few years ago, in 2007, and the head of public policy at Google then said he expected within a few years, Google and Facebook will be asked to put live and online all the public and private surveillance cameras that are now distributed throughout the world. So if that happened, you could do exactly what your not-so-hypothetical suggested. You could click onto Google, on a picture of me, for example, on the street, back-click on to see where I came from, forward-click to see where I'm going after the show, and basically have 24/7 surveillance of everyone in the world at all time.
This is depressing.
If the police started, it's terrifying. People gasp when they hear this, but it's not science fiction. And what's so remarkable about this Supreme Court case is if the court had accepted the Obama administration's claim that we have no expectation of privacy in public, then there'd be no constitutional limitations on this 24/7 surveillance Google system. But thankfully, you know, five justices seem to reject that.
I think of Obama as a left-leaning guy. What thought is behind that? Is that just a technical thing? Is there some deep thought? I mean, some deep sort of philosophical, theoretical thought about a person and a relationship to the public sphere such that, okay, you're out there in public, on the streets, on the sidewalks, and we can just tape whatever goes on there. So you have no, I mean, what's the thought behind that?
You know, I think the U.S. Solicitor General's office, which makes these arguments, tends to be very pro-police in both conservative and Democratic administrations, and they'll just take whatever they can get. And since a bunch of lower courts had bought this absurd claim, I think they just decided to push it as far as it was worth. But there was this wonderful moment in the oral argument with the court where Chief Justice John Roberts asked the government lawyer, is it the government's position that you could put GPS devices on the bottom of the members of the cars of this court and track us, track the justices 24/7? And when the lawyer said yes, I think he may have lost the case.
But I mean, Obama's a constitutional lawyer. I mean, he doesn't just ignore what his solicitor general is taking to the Supreme Court, does he?
He certainly doesn't. I mean, I guess I should boast or disclose that the acting solicitor general who formulated this position is my brother-in-law and dear friend, Neil Katyal. So it was, we obviously didn't see eye to eye on this question.
Okay, when you're out in public, I mean, you are out in public, and people, you know, a policeman has the right to look at you out in public, right? I mean, you're out in public, you're in the public street. He may not come up and search you, but he can look at you and observe your behavior. Why can't he put a camera up there in a public sphere? Why can't the constable put a camera up there in a public sphere and just look at you, just as the police on the street would look at you?
This was the big debate in the case, and the government said, sure.
Well, I want to know theoretically. I know what
theoretically, there's a huge difference, which is obvious immediately as soon as you phrase it, between a cop who might glimpse at you for a minute or even for an hour or follow you for 100 miles and 1,000 or 1,000,000 policemen who are trailing you, never leaving your side at all times, or planting cameras in your clothes that leave you no immunity from surveillance.
Well,
I'm going to challenge you there, Jeff.
Suppose I posted a policeman at every corner. Nothing would prevent me from posting a policeman at every corner and from those policemen communicating with each other about what's happening at the corner. So policeman X says to policeman Y, this is what's happening at my corner. And policeman Y says, this is what's happening at my corner. And they pass it along a chain of Z. Now, just replace those policemen. That's all right under the Constitution, I would assume. Just replace those policemen with cameras.
I think it wouldn't be all right under the Constitution. It would be a police state if those policemen talked to each other, recorded their conclusions, and basically tracked individuals without cause 24/7. That's the whole point of the fact that it becomes much more invasive than a single cop on the beat. I mean, it's intuitively obvious and philosophically obvious that it's different. It's much more intrusive.
I agree with you. It's intuitively and philosophically obvious, but it might be a little hard to work it out. I mean, it's a kind of an each and all problem. I mean, each shopkeeper has a right to have a camera, and then why can't you consolidate them? Anyway, well, what you say is the reasonable thing. I mean, if somebody comes out of a jewelry shop holding a swag bag, that's suspicious behavior, and then it seems like it might be reasonable to try to look at the under shopkeeper's cameras and see which way he went down the street. But if we're all just as a matter of course being tracked, whether we're behaving suspiciously or not, seems like an invasion. But boy, that would be a hard line to draw, wouldn't it?
It's a very hard line to draw, and it's interesting the court struggled with this because Justice Alito said a month is too long, but a day might be okay, and I'm not able to specify the point in between, the Goldilocks point at which too little becomes too much. Alito said if the police are unsure, they can always get a warrant, but it was remarkable that he, this great formalist, conservative judge, was willing to tolerate a degree of imprecision and to say that the line is hard to draw, but courts have to draw it somehow.
Can we distinguish sort of intellectually between tracking a person? I think tracking a person without cause is one thing, but tracking the scene, that is, you know, we have an emergency response team at every corner, and they're looking for emergencies. I'm not tracking any particular person, but I'm tracking the scene. Do the police not have the right? I don't want to sound like an anti-privacy person, but I'm a little unsure about why once you go in the public, the police don't have the right, without tracking you, just to observe what's happening in the public. And if they consolidate that into a big representation of what's happening in the public, they're still not tracking you.
Well, I think it's a good question and series of distinctions. They certainly have the right to have cameras on individual corners to look for suspicious activity and to watch those without any individualized suspicion. And then the question is, can they link all the cameras on all the corners, run them all live, and then track individuals without suspicion on this linked camera system?
Right.
I think it's when you begin to do the tracking of individuals without some degree of suspicion that the search becomes unreasonable.
So I guess the question might be where you stop this. You might think, well, no, it's all right to have cameras everywhere. It's all right to consolidate them into this great moving picture of the world. But that whole thing should be private, and you should need a search warrant to go in there and track any particular individual. Or you might say, oh, no, the cat's way out of the bag once you've got this moving picture of the whole world online.
And if it's private, that means owned by Google or Facebook or somebody, and that's as scary as heck. Don't you think?
Absolutely. Yes. So what standard should be used? You could require a warrant. Some cities that have set up these camera systems have an administrative system where there has to be approval from a top official. You can only keep the cameras on for a certain period of time in response to a threat. And most important of all, the data is deleted. It's the storage rules that's crucial. When it sits forever in Google servers, I might fear future invasions. But if the government is going to delete these surveillance cameras after a month, then that might be an important protection as well.
Jeff, you know, one last thought. You know, people used to fear Big Brother, the government. And you're starting to make me fear Big Brother, the corporation. Is that a reasonable fear or not?
It absolutely is. I mean, some people call this little brothers, the individuals watching each other using corporate-owned servers. But there's no question that right now, if you want to know who has power over privacy and free speech, it's not Justice Alito. It's the lawyers at Google and Facebook.
Jeff, this has been a very interesting conversation, raised lots of stuff. We've got to have you back and continue it sometimes. And thank you for joining us, though.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Jeff Rosen. He's a professor of law from George Washington University. He's legal affairs editor of The New Republic, and he's a co-editor of Constitution 3.0, Freedom and Technological Change. So, John, you want to share some of your thoughts, or you want to keep them private at this
point? No, I keep my thoughts private, Ken. I mean, you know, I give them to you. You'll put them on Facebook. Pretty soon they'll be in a database somewhere. People all know my thoughts. I'm going to keep everything private. Come to think of it, I'm going to put a sack over my face when I leave the building, and see if I can drive home without anyone capturing me on a video cam.
You might hit something though if you tried that. But you know what? I think this is really interesting stuff. I'm not sure that our expectations of privacy can survive in this highly technological age in which you automatically share things with everybody. And, you know, I do think, although the government is a threat to privacy, an overly intrusive government, it's the power of the big corporations and the way they do advertising and the way they collect data and just the technology that's privately owned.
Well, you know, when I listen to when I watch the Republican debates, which I do as a form of self-flagellation, the most bearable parts are usually Ron Paul, but he worries about the government. He never worries about private enterprise. Is anybody on the right worrying about all this?
Well, that's a very good question, and maybe we can answer it on our blog, where this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is Cogito Ergo Blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you can follow us on Twitter and find out more by visiting our very active and very public Facebook page.
And we've got a great webpage, philosophytalk.org. And guess what? You can go there and you can sign up to get a free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website in case you missed the show or just want to hear it three or four more times. Now we're going to go to Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, and he's going to peer into our private lives.
Ian Scholes, Google recently updated its privacy policy to offer more personalized cross-service integration. This means targeted ads based on what you watch on YouTube or maybe an alert telling you you're late for a meeting based on your Google Calendar. Yes, if you miss a conference call, an algorithm will scold you. Say thank you, Internet. And in the government, a 2005 report from the Government Accountability Office examined 199 data mining efforts from various agencies. Among them, 15 were designed to discover criminal activity, 14 to root out terrorists, and 70 designed to improve service and performance. So the main benefit of all this data mining goes to number crunchers, marketing gurus, and a few spies. How is my privacy affected? Well, recently a friend recommended a musician. Call him Bobby Bobson. I looked him up and listened to some music samples. Not for me, but the next time I went to Amazon, like an overeager clerk, Amazon presented every CD by that artist for my purchasing consideration. I didn't like Bobby Bobson, yet suddenly I was a Bobby Bobson completist. And under books I might want to buy, there was the new biography of Richard Nixon, which claimed that he was a closeted gay man who had to be taught how to kiss a woman in special Secret Service training sessions, a claim I found unlikely. I mean, he had two daughters before he even became president. Kissing was probably involved. So I never intended to buy this book, and yet there it was, along with other Nixon books. A mild curiosity about an iffy factoid suddenly seemed like an unhealthy infatuation with the former president. The worst that could happen? I get a free membership in the Bobby Bobson fan club. Who wants that? Or I'm sent to Guantanamo to be waterboarded until I reveal precisely the nature of my obsession with Richard Nixon. I don't really lose my privacy here. The private sector can turn me into an aggregate of purchasing trends. The public sector can turn me into an aggregate of interest counter to those of the government. But I'm still me. When I think of privacy threats, I think of reality television. Specifically, I think of The Jersey Shore, which follows a group of real young people willing and ready to invite camera crews into their lives in exchange for notoriety and, of course, money. As far as money goes, in the third season of the popular show, I learned that Jersey Shore star Snooki took home $30,000 per episode. She also makes personal appearances, getting $11,000 just to show up at a nail salon opening. What did she do there? I don't know. If her fans were really lucky, maybe they got to see her get a pedicure. But at some point, the cameras will stop rolling. America will no longer pay attention to them. Their privacy will be restored. And they'll all be filthy rich. And I'll still be broke, privacy intact, alone with my complete collection of an emo hipster rocker singing twee little songs about his bland little anguishes. There are worse fates, I suppose, but I can't imagine them. I gotta go.
The Wisdom of the Ages, in a nutshell, from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2012.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. The director of research is Laura McGuire.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation and from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Hey, this is Stephen Dubner from Freakonomics Radio. Every 2 weeks, we pay a visit to that public radio guy with the weird name.
So the really interesting thing is that I can't even tell you the number of times we have gotten listener mail with people saying either Guy, Gee, Kay. They don't like how I pronounce my own name. They don't know how to spell it. It's Norwegian, people.
He's Kai Rizdal, and you're not. Thanks for downloading the latest Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace podcast.
Freakonomics Radio explores the hidden side of everything. Sponsoring the Freakonomics podcast could help nearly a million listeners a week discover your business. Email us at sponsorship@wnyc.org.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Rizdal.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. And Dubner, you know what? I'm especially glad to have you back this week. You know why?
I know why.
You do. I know. You sent me something. I love it when you send me things.
I sent you something. What can I tell you? I'm a benevolent kind of fella.
That's right.
So go ahead, Kai. Open up your little package.
All right. Here we go. All right. It's a little bubble wrap envelope with an envelope inside.
Very careful.
Very careful. With okay, so it's a pack of Marlboros, and I don't smoke, dude.
Believe it or not, I'm trying to help you stay trim. All right, so I want you to listen to Kip Viscusi, who's an economist at Vanderbilt who studies smoking.
All right.
Well, one thing is that if you give up smoking, you'll gain some weight. May not be enough to make you morbidly obese, but it'll make you a little heavier.
All right, so here's the hidden side, right? It's the unintended consequences of giving up
you
smoking.
Are learning, my friend, Kai. So
how long have we been doing this segment?
A couple of years, but you're
That's
getting
right.
there,
All
you
right.
know. So
our
smoking rate in this country has been falling dramatically, which is fantastic news. But there's a hidden side to that, as with everything. Now, listen, I am not saying that smoking is a good way to fight weight gain. Let me be clear, okay?
Yes.
It is not, and smoking is bad for you.
Very.
But this is an instructive lesson about trade-offs, because I want to talk today about another weight-related trade-off having to do with our economy. So, Kai, let me ask you this question. What do you think that the Great Recession has done to our collective waistline?
Yeah, okay, I'm going to go with my gut. It's a bad thing, right? Because people are going to McDonald's for the dollar menu and all that stuff, right? And thus we're getting fatter.
That is a fantastic guess, and you might even be right this time.
I'm wrong, but anyway.
Usually you are, but some research suggests that you may be right, but there's other research that suggests the opposite. So let me play the opposite. Here's Christopher Room, who's an economist at the University of Virginia.
Okay.
What we've learned over the last decade or so is an initially surprising fact that when times are bad, people get healthier over many dimensions. And one of those appears to be obesity. So that, for example, if my income is down, I don't go out to eat as often, and meals eaten out of the home are probably less healthy and more caloric.
All right. Makes sense on its face, but I'm still not convinced.
Well, you know, here's the thing. Obesity is one of those problems that has a lot of different causes, right? And not all of them are obvious. You were right to focus on the relationship between dollars and calories. That is incredibly important to consider. I mean, think about this. For the vast majority of human civilization, it was a big struggle for us to provide enough affordable calories for everyone.
Right.
But over the past few generations, we have gotten very, very good, particularly rich nations like ours, at making calories abundant and delicious and cheap. The markets have given us exactly what we wanted, and now we're dealing with a side effect.
Well, so are you saying then we should intervene in the markets and make those calories more expensive? I mean,
well, look, I'm not a big intervener kind of guy,
that's right.
But that's the right question to ask. Let's go back to your cigarettes that I sent you, okay, and talk about how the incentives work.
Okay.
That pack I sent you cost, believe it or not, $12 here in New York City.
No way, really?
And about half of that was taxes. Now, economists generally agree that cigarette taxes have helped drive down smoking. So if you raise the price of cigarettes a little bit, consumption falls.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why, if you want to talk about obesity now, some people like the idea of a fat tax,
mm-hmm.
which is a tax on fat foods, not fat people, by the way. And they've tried this in Denmark and Hungary, and there's some talk of trying it here.
Yeah, but that's never going to fly, right?
It is a classic regressive tax.
Yeah.
It would hit harder low-income people than high-income people, which makes it tough. Another tough sell is to change the food subsidies coming out of Washington, right? So there's billions of subsidy dollars that now go to corn and wheat and soy, none of which are bad in and of themselves, but products of those get turned into very, very, very cheap additives in junk food. So one argument is that we should shift those subsidies toward things like, you know, fruits and vegetables. So it's cheaper to eat healthier.
Which makes sense. All right. So do me a favor next time you send me something.
Yeah.
Make it fruits or vegetables or beer actually would be good too. You could send more beer.
Right? Light beer. It's on the way.
No, right. Not light beer, but that's a whole nother segment. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. He's back in a couple of weeks. See ya.
My pleasure, Kai. Thank you.
This song says, no matter who you are.
Smog, garbage, sewers, car exhaust. Today's world puts our sense of smell on overload. Luckily, there are places we can go to refocus our senses. Our national wildlife refuges. When you visit, your nose will instantly recognize the purity of nature. Bask in the aromatic scent of the black pine trees blowing in the wind. Detect the sweet fragrance of primroses, wild violets. The way we found it. With over 500 refuges across America, you don't have to go far to make a special connection with nature. Learn more at fws.gov/refuges. That's fws.gov/refuges.
Criminal justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize the importance of balancing the needs of society to maintain social order against the need to safeguard individual rights. For more information on the HFCC Associate Degree Program in Criminal Justice, contact the Criminal Justice Department at one of the following numbers: 313-845-6437, 313-845-9714, or 313-845-9859.